This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann. We're speaking with Western Michigan University anthropologist Michael Nassany. He's just published a book, The Archaeology of the North American Fur Trade, which draws on research from the Fort St. Joseph archaeological site in Niles. Nassany says our understanding of the once thriving economy built on North American fur has evolved, in part due to new research, in part from reinterpreting information already gathered. I spoke with him about why he feels it's important to re-examine the fur trade. Michael Nassany, welcome to West Southwest.
Thanks for having me.
Many of us probably have not spent much time with the history of the fur trade. We may think of it as a detail in American history, maybe one we spent a few days on and maybe as long ago as grade school. You've gone very deep into the history of this economy, and you make the case that it's important to understand it more thoroughly than we have. And so why? Why research and why talk about the fur trade now?
Well, I think you can answer that in a couple of different ways. One would be space and one is time, right? So in terms of space, it was an expansive activity. So from Acadia in what is now Canada and the Atlantic seaboard all the way to the Pacific Northwest and from the Gulf of Mexico all the way to Hudson's Bay. So it was just a massive enterprise spatially and then temporally, right? It had its origins in the 16th century, and it really continued well on up into the 19th century. Indeed, there's some fur trading that goes on today, but it's quite limited in scope, and most furs that we obtain are probably from farm-raised animals for the most part. But nevertheless, it ran for about four centuries, and so that's another reason that it had a dramatic impact on American society and American history.
Before we get into the particulars of the fur trade, I want to talk for a moment about fur. When this economy gets underway in the 16th century, what role does fur play in people's lives?
Well, when we say fur, we're really referring to, it could be pelts, it could be skins, it could be hides. And in the case of the beaver, some have referred to it really as a fiber trade because it wasn't so much the long guard hairs of the beaver, but it was the little short, tiny hairs of the beaver right near the beaver's skin that was shaved off and collected and made into a felt. It was felted, and this is what beaver hats were made of. And of course, these were all the rage throughout most of Europe and, of course, here in the Americas as well, throughout the 17th and 18th centuries. And it was only in the 19th century when that felt became replaced by other fabrics did beaver go into decline.
Did most people, most Europeans, everyday Europeans, have goods, items made out of fur?
Well, the hats that I refer to, for that matter, all hats, marked people's social status. And so we probably know, even people who are as old as me can remember, that in the 1960s, at least into the 1960s, most men wore hats. And this is the case for hundreds of years in Europe, right? And so hats marked one's social status. So people of different statuses would have had different types of hats. Only the upper class, though, for the most part, could have worn fine beaver hats for the most part.
These days we think of fur as a luxury good, and a controversial one at that. Was it considered a luxury good during the time of the fur trade?
Well, in the sense that these beaver hats could only be worn by the elite, but I should say that it wasn't only beaver fur that was in demand. There are various other animals that gave up their skins and hides and pelts for various reasons. Little critters like muskrats, and minks that we're familiar with, and marten and fisher that we're familiar with, but also deer, of course, bison or buffalo. And then on the Pacific coast, in the cold waters of the Pacific, the sea otter. And those furs, in fact, were used for fur coats by, of all people, the Chinese nobility. So the fur trade in North America extended all the way to China in some ways. These furs were first exploited by the Russians, and then American sailors got involved in it, and it became quite lucrative for about 40 or 50 years in the Pacific Northwest.
they have furry animals in Europe, too. Why the need for fur from the Americas?
Well, they had furry animals in the Northwest for the most part. They were pretty much hunted out. And as early as the 11th and 12th century, Europeans were looking to points east and obtaining furs from Russians and from other Slavic groups in Eastern Europe, what is now sort of the, you know, what is now Russia. And it's what's interesting is that expansion and search for furs extended east from Europe. And of course, it extended then west from Europe into North America, and it ultimately meets up in Alaska in the 18th century and becomes a truly global phenomenon.
So you have this kind of convergence of the fur trade in Alaska from east and west.
Exactly, exactly.
Aside from hats and coats, what else were people using these furs to make?
Well, deer, you know, deer skins, for example, were being used for the bindings of books, for harnesses, for gloves, breech clouts, these sorts of things. But you know, those pretty much the main uses of these furs were leather, and then furs for clothing, and then these this felt for these hats. Bison robes. So if you can picture these, maybe Currier and Ives prints of the late 19th or early 20th century. They're popular on calendars and that sort of thing. Around this time of year, around the holidays, you'd see a sleigh, and then people would often cover themselves with some kind of a blanket, or more often a robe, and it would actually be a bison robe. So these were also used in that way.
Is there a way to quantify how important this economy was to the overall North American economy at the time it was in play?
Yeah, I haven't done that kind of economic analysis, but I have argued in the book that there are no archaeological sites in North America. There were no groups of people who were not impacted by the fur trade for some 400 years. So even if people weren't directly involved as fur traders, or, of course, the native peoples were the primary producers, they were the ones who were actually hunting the animals and processing the furs to be exchanged to Europeans for imported goods like kettles and cloth and iron implements and so forth. In addition to those roles that those people played directly in the fur trade, there are all sorts of spin-offs, if you will. So, for example, the Russell Cutlery Company in Massachusetts, founded in the 1830s, those knives were ostensibly used by the mountain men in the western part of North America in the trade that they were involved in. The place settings of ceramics that were found on the tables of Boston, Philadelphia, New York elites before and after the Revolution were brought from China, and those goods in China were ultimately acquired through the exchange of furs. So it's just a whole sequence of events as part of a larger network whereby everyone was touched in one way or another by the fur trade.
Fur is moving out of North America and being traded for other goods. You mentioned China from Asia, from China. What about goods coming from Europe? What was coming back into the Americas in exchange for this fur?
Yeah, so one of the things that that producers in Europe were as interested in, of course, is they were seeking cheaper raw materials like furs, but they were also looking for markets to dispose of the goods that they were producing. So when we think of the Industrial Revolution, for example, in England in the 18th century and the production of textiles, right, the English peasantry or the English working class could only be sold so much in the way of textiles. So the challenge was to distribute this more broadly. And indeed, opening up markets was part and parcel of what they sought to do. So the main products, for a long time, people, archaeologists among them, thought that the main goods being traded were objects like copper kettles and iron implements like axes and knives and hoes and so forth. And indeed, these were exchanged, and alcohol, they thought, and these were exchanged. But when trade lists are actually quantified, while we see those types of objects, those durable goods in the archaeological record, what we actually find when we look at trade lists and quantify them is that cloth was invariably the most important item that was being exchanged. Upwards of 60, 70, 80% of volume as well as expense for the most part. And it makes some sense because as native peoples were moving away from using animals and animal products for their own clothing and essentially diverting those goods to Europeans, they required a substitute. And woolen cloth predominantly, although some other fibers were also imported, became the mainstay. Oftentimes, though, interestingly, used in native styles. So not so much clothing per se, but the cloth was what was desired. So they could fabricate it in ways that were suitable to native tastes.
That brings me to the question of who was involved in the fur trade. Who are the people who are making these exchanges? Who's going out and actually trapping the animals?
Yeah, well, the native peoples are trapping the animals. In the early phases of the fur trade, the expectation was that native peoples would bring the furs to major trading centers. Like, for example, for the French, one of the major trading centers would have been in Montreal. So there were Montreal merchants there, and they were exchanging goods that had been imported from Europe for the furs in these trade fairs in the late 17th century. But over time, well, there came to be a bit of an illegal fur trade where traders who were not licensed would go out into the woods, runners of the woods, they're called the coureurs de bois. We see an expansion of the trade itself with Europeans actually moving into the hinterlands, into places like here in Michigan, in the western Great Lakes, the Haut Pays, the Pays d'en Haut, the upper country. So they're moving here, and much of the trade then takes place actually in closer proximity to where the furs are being harvested.
What were the relationships like between Native Americans and Europeans who were involved in this fur trade?
Yeah, and this is what I try to focus on in the book, is the nature of the relationships. And this is what drew me into the work, is trying to understand the relationships between Native peoples and Europeans. And simplistically, perhaps, it's quite variable, depending on whether one is English or French or Dutch or Spanish, and if one is encountering the Cherokee or the Potawatomi or the Narragansett or the Mi'kmaq, the outcomes were quite variable. Generally speaking, though, the English had more of a sort of a business-like manner to their view of the trade. They were hesitant to provide native peoples with unnecessary gifts. So they saw the trade as more as an economic mercantilist transaction. And that was partly because they were, in some places, numerically superior to native peoples. But in the case of the French strategy, because there was far fewer French people, was to establish close alliances with native peoples, often to intermarry, and often to provide gifts in advance of serious trading and so forth. And so, in a sense, you can say it was more of a social and a political relationship than it was an economic one, although the fur trade was the glue of the relationship that bound these two groups together in their alliance.
Did that stay fairly consistent between the start of the fur trade and the end of it, that perhaps more political relationship between French traders and Native Americans?
Well, in the case of the French, there was pretty close relationships with Native peoples throughout their regime in North America. Of course, they're defeated at the end of the Seven Years' War in the 1760s, and places like Fort St. Joseph and Michilimackinac, other places in Michigan, are then taken over by the English. And it's quite interesting because in this case, in the case of these particular places, the British did implement their policy. They thought it encouraged laziness on the part of natives to give them gunpowder and musket balls and these sorts of things, or a little alcohol to ease the trading relationship. They were not prone to doing that. And in fact, the native peoples who were used to that treatment under the French basically rose up and attacked a number of the sites, including Fort St. Joseph, Michilimackinac, Detroit, in what we now know as Pontiac's Rebellion. And so this was a tactical error on the part of the English and ultimately might have contributed to their demise even up into the American Revolution. So all of these activities and these events have a sort of a domino effect and have repercussions for subsequent relationships and activities on the continent. So the fur trade was also intertwined with these major political shifts that took place in North America. And the contestation of the continent was, again, conducted in tandem with the fur trade, and they really can't be separated.
Another thing that you address in the book is the difference between how we're looking at, interpreting, understanding the fur trade now and how it's been presented in the past. And there's a part where you describe a kind of postcard stereotype version of the fur trade as it was maybe once presented. And, of course, the entire book is moving away from that. So what is that kind of, two-dimensional version of the fur trade that we've been presented with sometimes in the past?
Yeah, I think it's a stereotypical caricature of this French Canadian voyageur with his native wife in a canoe, singing merry songs and so on, with his tassel tossed to one side, the tassel of his hat tossed to one side of his head, canoeing along a idyllic river somewhere in North America. In essence, that was really replaced. I think there is a kernel of truth there, if you will, insofar as there were close relationships between French voyageurs and native hosts and native women. I think that's very true. But with the coming of the English, with the Anglo presence and with an Anglo narrative, this voyageur was seen as a bit too frivolous. And this was really discounted to a great extent. And instead, the values of the more individualistic mountain men of the 1850s and 60s, I think, is what sort of resonates more with in the American legacy and so on. And so it's a bit tricky, I think, sorting these things out. But it's just interesting to see how the fur trade has been remembered and how those remembrances have changed over time. So with regard to the way it's been remembered, it seems like part of the dominant narrative, if you will, has been also the role of the European traders and the importance of the goods that they provided to native peoples and the importance of the civilizing effect that their presence has had. And so that narrative, which still probably exists in museum exhibits and maybe in the popular imagination, is that of a history of the fur trade whereby Europeans show up with superior goods, native peoples welcome the goods, and they ultimately assimilate or they are displaced by Europeans. What the archaeology shows us when we look a little bit more carefully at the types of goods that native peoples are adopting is that, first off, they're very selective in what they're choosing to acquire. So they're not interested in just any frivolous object that Europeans are looking to sell. They have specifications for the colors of cloth. They have specifications for the quality of kettles, the gauge of the metal, and so forth, and likewise with the colors of glass beads and so on. So they have clear desires, and so they're seeking objects that basically fit into their native cosmologies and native belief systems. The other thing we see is that oftentimes it's not so much European goods that they're really interested in, particularly in the early period, but it's more so European goods as raw materials. So they're taking the objects, things like kettles, for example, and they're not using them the way they were intended to be used by their makers. Instead, they're cutting them up into little shapes that they can use as ornaments. They're scoring them and producing arrow points out of the metal and so on. They're taking the barrels of guns and flattening them and using them as scrapers for hides and so on. So it's quite interesting when we look very closely at the objects and the way they're being modified in native hands. It suggests, in fact, that native peoples had their own designs for these objects, and it implies that indeed they had agency. They were trying to determine their own histories and live within the ways that they were familiar, rather than just simply adopting European practices.
What are some of the objects or records that you found at Fort St. Joseph, and how have they shaped your understanding of the fur trade and those relationships it contained?
Yeah, in a couple of different ways. And one relates to the point I was just making. So, you know, one of the objects, I'm often asked about my favorite artifact, and, you know, one of the objects that's quite provocative is a thimble. And we have found several thimbles. And, of course, most of your listeners know what thimbles were used for in sewing and so on. And they were certainly used that way. But we found one that was perforated.
Which wouldn't do you much good if you're using it to protect your thumb while you sew.
Exactly. And so that suggests to us, in the context that it was found in, near these little pits that we use for smoking hides, suggests to us that there's something else going on there. And we have seen examples in museums of native garments from, for example, from the 19th century, where these thimbles have been attached to clothing, a whole series of them, and they would have dangled up against each other and made a pleasing sort of tinkling sound and so on. And so this is a complete reconceptualization of the way in which thimbles were meant to be used and so on. So that's one of the specific artifacts. More generally at the site, what we're seeing is evidence of artifacts that are inspired by native practices or were similar to objects that natives had produced even before the French were there, commingled with artifacts that were imported. So that suggests to us that the area we've been working on the site is probably represents, and we've identified four or five structures in that area, these buildings are probably the buildings of fur traders and their native wives. So it suggests to us the very close relationships that existed between the French and the native people. Of course, the native people also lived directly across the river from the fort. And so when we think of a fort, we think of it as a defensive structure. But in this instance, it probably was meant really in a more symbolic way. It probably couldn't be defended since there were only about 50 or so French living there at its peak population, and there were upwards of 1,000 native peoples living in close proximity. So the best defense was establishing close relationships, and that was probably the best defense against any animosities that could arise.
When was Fort St. Joseph established, and when did it reach its heyday?
So the beginnings of Fort St. Joseph, or at least where the site is today, in the 1680s, the Jesuits were granted a tract of land there to establish their mission. And the fort was officially established in 1691. It was occupied sporadically for the first couple of decades because of some political instabilities. But after about 1700 or so, there was a permanent French presence there. By about the 1720s, 1730s, we know there was a commandant. There were about 8 officers. There were 8 to 10 soldiers, enlisted men. There was a blacksmith. We know him by name. We know where he was working. We found some of the objects from his workshop. There was an interpreter. There was a priest who visited the site from time to time. There were about 15 fur traders and their native French Canadian, as well as French wives and children. So there was some 50 or 60 people living at Fort St. Joseph in the 1730s and 40s. So that was probably about as large as the site ever became. After the English took the site over and it was attacked during Pontiac's Rebellion, the English didn't re-garrison the site. French fur traders stayed there until 1781, when it was finally abandoned. Some of the fur traders were actually deported to Michilimackinac around that time. And then, of course, one of the chapters in Fort St. Joseph's history was its attack by Spanish forces from the St. Louis area. But in some ways, this is merely a footnote and really has very little impact on any of the fur trade work that we've been doing.
The fur trade itself did endure into the 19th century. Is that correct?
It did, even in the area of the St. Joseph River Valley. What's interesting is some authors have argued, and I would have to agree with them, it's true that in some areas animal populations were decimated, and so the fur trade just couldn't continue there. But in other areas, these animal populations were capable of rebounding fairly quickly. What had happened is was native peoples were removed, and so the primary producers were gone, and that's what ultimately led to the decline of the trade. But here, for instance, in the Kalamazoo River Valley, in the St. Joseph River Valley, in the Grand River, there was the American Fur Company was in operation well into the 1840s and 50s and so on. Now, there had been a shift in the types of animals they were acquiring. By the end of the 18th century, there's a decline in beaver. And interestingly, it's replaced by muskrat. So there were literally thousands upon thousands of muskrats that were harvested by the American Fur Company out of its Detroit office and out of other little fur trade centers, fur trade posts here and there by independent traders working for the American Fur Company in the 1830s and 40s.
Beyond the 1830s and 40s, is it also that demand for these goods declined over time?
Yeah, I think that's certainly part of it. As I mentioned earlier, for example, there are new raw materials available. So as silk, for example, becomes available and other fabrics, then those beaver hats go out of style. Also, for instance, I mentioned deer skins would often be used for the leather of book covers and, you know, that sort of thing. This is being replaced by domesticated animals. So cow leather is being used in that instance. So there are these replacements that are taking place that ultimately lead to the decline. The other element that maybe I don't explore as much as I could have in the book, maybe because it doesn't have as much of an archaeological signature, is the competition between fur traders and agriculturalists. So, for example, when most pioneers came into Michigan after statehood during the 1830s, the 1840s, they really weren't at that point coming here to be fur traders. It's not to say there weren't people exploiting furs, but they were really coming to till the land. And ultimately, farming and fur trading and fur harvesting are inconsistent with each other.
Are they?
Yeah, well, I mean, because the habitat, basically, for animals become diminished, for one thing. And native peoples, for example, were not prone to adopt domesticated animals. Only when they were essentially forced, when there were fewer options, did they actually move in that direction. But a more mobile hunter-gatherer, you could say, life way, is inconsistent in some ways with a more settled agricultural life. And there are examples of the conflict, if you will, the encounter and conflict, sometimes interaction in a positive way, exchange across that border, but oftentimes it's agriculturalists who are displacing hunter-gatherers. And that's ultimately the history of the last 10,000 years, too. That is what archaeology tells us.
Is there more to discover at Fort St. Joseph? And what are the questions you're looking forward to exploring in the future?
Well, what we've been focusing on at Fort St. Joseph, there's a lot of local interest in seeing some kind of a reconstruction of the fort. And so we've been focusing on some of the architectural remains. We've identified a number of fireplaces, some foundation walls, some posts, upright posts that would have been part of these buildings, as well as other architectural remains, hinges and nails and so on. And we're trying to get a sense of how large these buildings were, how they were constructed, and then look closely at the contents of the building so we can understand a little bit more about the actual occupants. We work in a fairly small area of the site. We've identified only five buildings so far. I described earlier 50, 60 people. There probably were maybe 20 buildings on the site at any one time. And so there's much more work to do. And we don't excavate that much each summer. We sort of pick away at it. We invite the public in to see what we're doing. We involve community groups through our summer camp program. We have an open house like I said, the public can come in and see archaeology, can talk to living history reenactors, can actually see firsthand the artifacts that are being recovered, and learn from public scholars about the work that we're doing. And I think that's really part of the process. And given the level of interest in it so far, we've had literally thousands of people who have visited the site in the last 10 years or so. I think this is an attraction that can be maintained for a very long time.
Is there an object you're hoping to find, or some kind of question that you're hoping some element of the site will help you answer?
Well, it's really more the latter, right? The questions than it is the objects, right? Because as archaeologists, the objects are merely they're forms of evidence that allow us to answer questions. And the questions we have really have to do with what was going on there and who was doing it, right? And that's what we're able to get a handle on by looking at these buildings, by paying attention to the locations of artifacts. Early in our excavations, we encountered the small concentration of gun parts. Not such a small concentration, perhaps, about 150 gun parts. And almost certainly this is the workshop of one of the gunsmiths, perhaps Antoine de Etre, who was working at the site in the 1730s and 1740s. So the kind of insight that a deposit like that provides is it allows us to see what he's making, what he's fixing, and so on, and to juxtapose that with documentary sources that we have about his activities. Because oftentimes what gets written down and what people are actually doing aren't one and the same. And so this is the way the archaeology can really clarify the historical documents and really provide us greater insight into what life was like in the 18th century at Fort St. Joseph and in the fur trade.
Michael Nasaney, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Michael Nasaney is a professor of anthropology at Western Michigan University. His book, The Archaeology of the North American Fur Trade, has just been published. You can hear a longer version of this interview at our website, wmuk.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann.